Hello and welcome back to Coffee with Conservationists, the podcast where I sit down with people who dedicate their lives to researching, protecting, and documenting nature. I talk to them about issues affecting wildlife, the climate, and global biodiversity. We cover diverse topics within ecology, biology, storytelling, activism, and much more. To start off, my chosen coffee feature today is Olfactory Coffee. This is a returning featured company, and I'll tell you a bit more at the end of the episode. Today, I talk with wildlife biologist and road ecologist Jessica Moreno. We talk about the field of road ecology and the importance of providing safe pastures for wildlife. I was quite sleepy during this episode and not 100% on my best form, but luckily Jessica was so passionate about her topic and carried the episode mostly on her own. So you'll learn a lot about road ecology in this episode, but you might not hear as much from me. Hi Jessica, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. This is pretty exciting.
We connected on Twitter after I kind of talked about wanting a few more kind of bit more diverse topics that I hadn't really covered before. And you popped on saying you'd like to talk about road ecology and kind of safe passages and safe crossings, which is something that I've never really focused on properly. Before we get into the kind of what that is and why you do what you do, could we talk about your origins for a bit? Kind of why you're here, where you got your start and your love for nature and wildlife and ecology?
Of course. Well, that could be a podcast all by itself. But yeah, so I'm Jessica Moreno, and I am a wildlife biologist. I grew up in Southern Arizona, so with the saguaros and the cactus in the desert, and really fell in love with the desert where I grew up. And the desert's such an interesting place because folks often think of it as a kind of dry, desolate area, but actually this place where I live in the Sonoran Desert is really diverse and has a very interesting biodiversity of species. We've got five seasons, actually, because our summer is split up into two. So we have a pre-summer, which gets extremely hot. And then we have a monsoon summer when the rains come and wildlife really start to move around at that time. And so I just really fell in love with the desert and the wildlife here and got into studying wildlife for my degree and fell into this really great career path studying animal movement in this area, which, you know, the Sonoran Desert, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it actually extends into Mexico as well as the U.S. It's this region-wide area. And it's also a significant part of the Sky Island region, or the Madrean Archipelago, we call it, which has this very interesting topography. So if you think about how wildlife move across a landscape, and all species are different, of course, here we have mountain ranges that are completely isolated from each other by a different biotic community. So we have desert in the lowlands, and then on the mountain ranges, as you go up in elevation, you can go from, you know, cactus to oak trees to pine trees and aspen trees at the top. So in a very short period of time, in an hour, you can drive from the desert all the way up to the aspens and see this huge array of different kinds of species. And then that also means that animals are moving across the landscape, not only between these mountain ranges as they disperse, but also up and down in elevation. So it's a very interesting place to study road ecology and wildlife movement. And I just kind of fell into it accidentally, following the things that I love to do, you know? But that's kind of how I got started. I got started as a kid walking up and down desert washes that were, we call them arroyos. They're dry and only flood part of the year. And so they become kind of like these roadways for wildlife, and you can follow animal tracks in the sand and That's a great fun thing to do as a kid when you're running around out in the desert. Right. So that was my introduction, I guess. How I
Yeah.
got into it.
Amazing. What could you tell us a bit more about the specifics of the biodiversity of the region? Kind of what species can be found there? Just a
Yeah,
little
and
sample of kind of how biodiverse it is.
yeah, it's really, really incredible. And if you're into birding, it's a place where people love to come bird because we have so many different species of birds come through here. And again, like the Sky Islands add like this whole other element of it because you have all these different biotic communities kind of clashing together in one place. So in the Sky Island region, which covers four states and two countries, that's Arizona, New Mexico, Sonora, and Chihuahua. You can find half the species of birds in North America right here.
Wow.
There's over 7,000 species of plants and animals altogether in that region. And then within just the Sonoran Desert, I don't know if I should say just, but in the Sonoran Desert alone, we have about 350 different bird species. We've got over 1,000 native bees. We also have amphibians, lots of reptiles. It's a great place for reptiles, of course. And we have about 30 native fish and 2,000 native plants. And, so there's actually a huge diversity of species. And it's one of the few places or only place in the world where you're going to find some of these species from different habitats coming together into one place. So in southern Arizona, here where I work, it's the only place where you'll see jaguars and black bears existing in the same canyons. We have ocelots, we have mountain lions, we've also got white-nosed coati and javelina, some of my favorite ones, And so there's a lot of really interesting species to study here. You could really dive in and just get really specialized in any one thing. Especially if you like bees, so that's
Oh.
kind of an example. I don't know. I could start listing things, but I don't know how familiar folks would be with some of these things. We
Yeah, I
have elegant
mean,
trogons and what's like the Sonoran Desert species that is like the iconic thing is the saguaro. We pronounce it saguaro. That's that kind of iconic cactus. An organ pipe cactus. But we also have creosote bush, which is what gives us that smell of the rain every year, and all the species that are adapted to those things, ironwood trees and cactus wrens and roadrunners. There's a
Yeah.
lot. I could just keep listing species forever, really. So
Yeah, I mean, I was just a super quick, like Google showed me kind of a massive range of them. And yeah, there will be a lot of my listeners who are scientists and who will know what a cactus wren is or a javelina or a desert cottontail, but then a lot
Yeah,
of people won't
rabbits.
know. And
Right.
so I think that, yeah, we like to keep it a mixture of, obviously
If
educational
folks
about
want to get
science,
kind of
but
a sense,
yeah,
yeah.
sorry,
If
sorry.
folks want to get a sense of that, there's a really great Arizona PBS film that you can find on YouTube or Google called Desert Dreams, and it's celebrates the seasons in the Sonoran Desert, and it's just background music and film of animals in the desert and through all the seasons. And it's really a good, it doesn't give you all the information, but it's a great experience of just all the different species and landscapes here that we deal
Amazing.
with.
Yeah, because I think
Yeah.
we try not to keep it too academic. Well, I try not to keep it
Right.
too niche because obviously, the subjects we talk about can be super specific, but then
Yeah.
not everyone who listens to the podcast is a scientist or has an academic background. So we like to be able to communicate
Has to
effectively.
be accessible, yes.
Yeah, it's got to be accessible to everyone. For example, I'm not from a scientific background at all. I'm not an academic. And so, yeah, I have to do a lot of research before talking to a guest myself. And so I know how that feels, and I'd like to make it accessible to everyone. We're going to go straight into the subject of today's podcast, road ecology, and safe movement of wildlife. It seems fairly self-explanatory. The ecology of roads, how they endanger wildlife, and how ecologists are working to stop that. Can you give us that academic breakdown of what that actually is?
Yeah, and actually, you know, it is the ecology of roads, because it's not just how we eliminate the threats to wildlife or landscapes that come with building or constructing roads in a place, but how animals kind of interact with that. Sometimes it's not all negative. There have been studies that show how species of plants and seed get spread along a roadway. How some birds will nest near roadways because predators aren't as prevalent next to a roadway, right? They're using the sound and the cars that are there to actually be a deterrent. So very interesting how some species kind of have adapted to that and used it. While others have been more negatively impacted. And one of the things that I love the most about road ecology is that it is a really interdisciplinary subject, and it's also a very win-win kind of conservation effort, because, you know, people across the world need to move around in different ways, and we currently have probably like 40 million miles of roadways on the planet and growing constantly. And some of those are major freeways, and some of those are just little dirt tracks out in the wilderness. But all of those have an impact, and they all make it difficult for some species to migrate in search of food or mates or new habitat. And that can start to affect population genetics. So for one example, here in the US, in Florida, we have the Florida panther, which is basically a mountain lion, but it's been so isolated by roads and development that the population is now inbred and it's starting to die out. So a lot of those lions, you know, are born with kinks in their tail and extra toes and stuff. And how do you solve that problem? You have to connect the habitat for them again. You have to provide the space for them to have the freedom to roam. In order for that population to continue to thrive. So those are some of the like larger examples of kind of that. Invasive plant species can spread along roadways. We have a big problem with that in the Sonoran Desert with an African species of grass called buffel grass that kind of takes over the desert because it's so fire adapted. And it spreads very easily in disturbed areas. So it'll grow up along our roadsides and then catch fire, and it will burn hot. And then, you know, the cactus die because they can't withstand that kind of hot fire. They're not adapted to that. But the grass will come right back up. So we end up like these buffel grass grasslands expanding further and further. And so that's one thing that we deal with here. But then you have other kinds of things that roads bring to, like pollutants that contaminate our water supplies. Road salt will do that, or just spills from the roadways. You get noise and light pollution that affect animal behavior. So there's a lot of aspects to study and to like dive into and learn about. But the solutions to a lot of these problems are, again, like really interesting and fun to work on. We have been working for a long time on building bridges and overpasses, and bridges for wildlife across some of these roadways. Everything from small little tunnels for salamanders and toads and turtles to, you know, big massive vegetated overpasses that pronghorn or elk and bear can travel across. And all of these two have to be connected in some way to a network of connected open space. So it's not in a silo about just putting a bridge across the highway. It's also about making sure that we're connecting habitat that these animals need to use. So, you know, building green belts, you might have heard of that term. It used to be, at least here in the US, we focused a lot historically on protecting big swaths of land and blocks, you know, like national parks and wilderness areas. But unless they're connected, they really just start getting more and more isolated, and that doesn't work out in the long term. So they really do need to have, we really do need to have like a connected network of open space that animals can use and plants can use to migrate and move in and out of these spaces. So, and roads get right in the way, right? So, and train tracks, there's lots of barriers in development itself too. So finding ways to thread the needle and help wildlife get to where they need to go is a big part of the work that we do. So, you know, I'm studying how animals move, the type of habitat they use, what they prefer. And then we're using that data to inform where we're going to build some of these structures and where we're going to protect open space, right?
Yeah, amazing. That was a really, really good answer. I think you answered several of my questions in one go.
Great.
So that was excellent. I think, yeah, I'm glad you put a positive spin on it, because I kind of knew some of the positives of it a little bit. But when you, if you're just, you know, a curious person, not someone who was, you know, obviously I actively researched the topic for this episode, but if you're someone who just Googles it, the first image that pops up is a Wikipedia image of a dead squirrel, like a squashed tree squirrel. So yeah. You immediately go, oh no, it's terrible, it's all bad. Like, I think the latest, I think it was a 2020 calculation, so it's a few years out of date, and you'll know more than me on this, obviously, but the last calculation I read was 350 million vertebrate animals die on US roads every year. I don't know if that figure's changed in the last 3 years at all.
It's higher, but also it's an estimate too, because it's very hard to count some of these things. So,
of course,
like for instance, when we're trying to find out where animals are crossing the road, there's a couple ways to do that, right? We can track specific animals, put collars on deer, use wildlife cameras in culverts under the road, but we can also measure roadkill. So, doing roadkill surveys is not a lot of our volunteers, it's not their favorite thing to do, but the data you can get from that can be super important. So it can be very important to use like the iNaturalist app to record where you see animals dead on the road or where you see live animals crossing the road, because that can give us a sense of where there's hot spots where animals are attempting to cross safely and unable to do that. And even, you know, this can be hard too when talking in the community about the importance of this, you know, where we have a wildlife bridge and a wildlife underpass that we constructed in the last 5 or 6 years near Catalina State Park across a state highway nearby. And it connects the Catalina State Park and the Catalina Mountains with the Tortolita Mountains for a number of species, mountain lions, black bears, white-nosed coati, white-tailed deer, javelina, bobcats, all of them. So, you know, but a lot of the neighbors who live in that area, it's actually a fairly suburban area. Some of them like having that closeness to the wildlife in the park there in their backyards and seeing bobcats come up to the bird feeder and drink water or whatnot. But others don't want other wildlife like javelina coming into their front yard and tearing up all their plants and flowers, right? Or rattlesnakes on the front porch. So it's sort of like this public relations job at the same time, where you're trying to get people to care, you know, that we're trying to stop animals from getting hit on the road. We're also trying to improve their population, their genetics, and allow them to roam freely where they need to, so we continue to have wildlife in the area and a healthy ecosystem. So it's like there's the big picture. There's also the individual picture when you're looking at individual animals hit on the road, which some people care more about than the big population side of things. And even if it's a squirrel hit on the road, you know, I might have one person in the public who's like, well, I don't care about the squirrels. I don't want to pay my tax dollars for this big project for squirrels, you know. The squirrel kind of also represents all the species that would be crossing there, that could be crossing there too. So we have these conversations with the public all the time. And it's pretty interesting because you never know where people are going to be coming from. And with snakes, especially, we find doing roadkill surveys that people will deliberately swerve to hit the snakes. So, you know, that's the problem. So roadkill surveys with data that show where the snakes are getting hit aren't necessarily great public outreach tools necessarily. Yeah. But deer and elk, mountain lion, make a bigger impact on people, I think, too. And part of that is a road safety issue. So one of the challenges of this work is that a lot of people get into road ecology because they love wildlife, they love wild spaces, and that's what they're trying to protect. And what you end up doing is a lot of interdisciplinary work where you're working with transportation planners and transportation engineers and public dollars. And that can get very challenging, not only because their priorities are totally different, you know, like for our state transportation agencies, they care about traffic accidents and liability towards the state. So if they can put in a wildlife crossing structure, then they can say, we've addressed this problem, and they like that.
I can imagine.
That's the way we go. So for that, to get funding for a lot of these projects, we're really looking at, like, what are the vehicle collisions that are occurring here? So less about where the roadkill hotspots are and more about where are people getting into accidents because they're hitting large animals or trying to avoid hitting large animals. So that's another aspect of it too. And again, that's kind of like an interesting thing about road ecology, where it can be a win-win, because if you're going to put in a wildlife bridge, it's very cool to see something tangible on the ground that you created that is helping wildlife, but also helping people at the same time, right? So we can use that kind of messaging also.
Yeah, leads on really nicely to what I was about to ask, which is, how do you kind of get people on your side? So that's what you've been explaining, and also how you work with local authorities. And they, I don't know what it's like in the US at all, but in the UK, if they can tick something off their box, they're very happy. So, you know, if they can get something done and it's not like massively complicated, and they say, okay, yeah, we've solved this problem by doing X, Y, and Z, and that's just out of their way now. They're happy, which, you know, if you're clever about it, you can use to your advantage.
Exactly. Absolutely. And in the US, it's actually even more of a stick more than a carrot, I should say, too, because in the US, we have the ability to sue our agencies, right, for things. So if someone gets in an accident and gets injured, they could sue the state and say, you didn't put up wildlife crossing signs or wildlife crossings or anything to stop this from happening, which is fairly ridiculous when you think about it. But it's very expensive to have to fight off lawsuits all the time, or settle them constantly. So being able to put up a wildlife crossing structure and say, well, we checked that box, so, you know, sorry, you know, the state likes that because it's cheaper for them in the long run. And that's kind of like, that's not a very optimistic way to look at it, I guess, but it does get the job done. And one of the arguments we do make too is that wildlife crossing structures, we've shown, pay for themselves in just a few years. There is a huge cost to the construction of a wildlife bridge or an underpass, and a lot of engineering has to go into it and planning. But because folks are then not hitting things on roads, then you have a reduction in crashes, insurance premiums going up, injuries, deaths, all those costs to society, costs to individual people on the roadway, go down. So
let me see.
After, you know, it does pay for itself in the long run. And the benefits keep growing too over time, because as species continue to use them, they also teach generationally a lot, like especially with deer, they will do this. So future generations of those species, that population will start to use it more and more and more. And we've seen that. We were really careful to say when the wildlife bridge, it was the first wildlife bridge in the Sonoran Desert ever built, that was built over there by Catalina State Park. And we were careful to say, you know, it's not going to be instantaneous. It might take a little while for animals to start to use it, you know. And we were just being careful, because that's usually the case. It takes a while. And that wasn't the case. We had a Sonoran Desert tortoise try to use the underpass during construction, and they had to stop construction because it's a protected animal. And they had to help the tortoise go through the underpass before they could start construction again. So it was really kind of a cute example of how you build it and they will come. And then, of course, also we also pair all of these crossing structures with wildlife funnel fencing. So talking about interdisciplinary, if you're into or familiar with ranching at all or anything like that, we deal with fences quite a bit, because we install wildlife funnel fencing so that animals who come up to the road are stopped by this fence, and then they kind of follow the fence and it funnels them right to the correct structure, right? We try to place structures where animals are trying to cross the road, but there's always considerations about topography or jurisdictions or, you know, utility lines or something. So it's never going to be perfect. And the fencing really helps the animals learn where the crossing is. And then over time, they start to use it more and more. And then in other places, we need wildlife fencing that is permeable, that animals can get through. So that's another aspect of it. Creating these fun little jump outs where animals who do accidentally get stuck onto the highway can get off and over that fence if they need to, right? And they're not trapped. So many considerations and, you know, things that you can really dive into and learn more about. But
yeah, it's an incredibly multifaceted topic, and something that I think I'll do a lot more personal reading on when I finish recording, because I think it's something that I'd be very interested to learn more about. You've already taught me a huge amount in the 30 minutes that we've been talking.
The whole idea of wildlife movement and wildlife corridors and linkages is just such a cool, fascinating idea. Anyway, there is a new book that I think just came out or is coming out, called Crossings: How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. It's a really good one. It's by an environmental journalist named Ben Goldfarb, and he's amazing. He's a really, really good writer. So that's a good introductory book that's kind of up to date, because it's just been published, about this topic too, that people can read.
Amazing. I'll link to it and post about it when the episode comes out. How do you monitor crossings, and kind of if wildlife are using a particular structure?
Oh yeah, that's a fun one. So we use wildlife camera traps. So these are wildlife cameras that have become more and more popular, and now people sometimes put them in their own backyards because now they're more affordable. When I first got started in this work, our camera traps were film, you know, and had a little wire attached to the flash that the pack rats would chew, and you'd only get 35 pictures at a time. So nowadays, of course, technology has grown by leaps and bounds, and there's like so many different types of models out there that you can use of these cameras that you place out on the landscape, and they're heat and motion sensing, kind of like a light on a porch would be. And so when an animal walks by, it triggers the camera to take a picture or a video. So we use those, and they're really great for these kind of like smaller specific areas where you have a culvert or an underpass or an overpass, and you can put in a little array of them and see what animals are approaching and not using the structure because they're nervous from the sound of the cars, and that's a problem you have to try to solve. Or you can see what is using them. And we collect all that data, and we use it to create what we call a passage rate. So This is like, you know, the number of animals that actually cross the crossing, use the crossing, from one end to the other. And we can see if animals are going in only one direction, if they're going in both directions. And again, like if some species are using them more and some are using them less. And we do find that certain species like different types of structures. So that's really important. Everything has to be really, you can apply lessons learned from other projects, but every location is going to have its own specific needs because of the specific habitat and species that are there. Like for instance, at this bridge site that I keep talking about near Catalina State Park, near my place, we actually have a bridge, and then a mile south of that, we have an underpass. We have both.
Okay.
And so we've placed wildlife cameras there, on the approaches of those structures, and then we've also placed them in the habitat surrounding in the area. So I can see the passage rate of what animals are using those particular structures. And I can also see what animals are in the area that could be potentially using those structures that we haven't seen on those structures yet. So one of the things we found was that deer really prefer the bridge, which you can imagine if you know deer. Makes sense because they want to have a clear view of sight. They're looking for predators. It's a unfamiliar place, you know, with a lot of noise and light, and so they're gonna want to be super tentative and careful. And so they prefer the bridges and the underpass. We see a lot of javelina moving through the underpass. Javelina, actually, they're really interesting critters. They're not. They look kind of like pigs, but they're not in the pig family at all. They're these tropical species that come up from Mexico and move in herds. So we get little herds of them, and they will squeeze through just about anything their head will fit through. And they're happy
Yeah.
to do that. But they don't like the bridge nearly as much, and they love the underpass. So they're using the underpass. And then we get
Interesting.
species that use both equally, like coyotes or coyotes will use both pretty equally, and bobcats. Tend to use the underpass more, but they'll use the bridge too. And it's just very interesting to see how different species are using the landscape slightly differently,
Yeah.
and what they prefer. So
Yeah, amazing.
knowing the species you're working with is really an important aspect of designing these.
Well, we only have a few more questions left, I think, because you've been so amazing in your explanations of the topic. The first one is, where can people find you if they want to follow your work, or if you wouldn't mind them following along with what you do? Where's the best place to keep
Yeah,
up to date with that?
you can find me on Twitter, at least for now, at Tracker Jessica, and I have the same handle on Spoutable. And you can also look up my work. I am a conservation science director for a little organization called the Coalition for Sonoran Desert Protection, and our website is sonorandesert.org, and you can learn about the desert and the work that I do there. Focused on road ecology and wildlife linkage protection.
Amazing. And last question, how do you take your coffee?
Oh, I like mine with cream and lots of sweetener, and chocolate. My favorite is the
Nice.
Miner's Blend from the Bisbee Coffee Company. So if you visit here and you want a tour of Tombstone in Bisbee,
Awesome. So yeah, thank you very much. I think we've kind of covered everything. And the meeting's going to end in a little bit. So all that's left to say is thank you so much for giving up your evening, or a portion of your evening, to come on
happy
and talk
to.
about something so cool.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. I always love talking about this stuff. So it's fun. It's been fun and great to meet you.
Thanks again to Jessica for taking the time to speak to me today. You can find links to her social media below. This episode, my featured coffee is from Olfactory Coffee Roasters. Olfactory are local to me down here in Cornwall and a really great company. Returning after a long break, I did feature them a while ago in season 2, I got hold of some of their organic decaf. Rios de Esperanza means Rivers of Hope and is sourced from the Acuilleras estate in Costa Rica.
The social welfare of their workers here is a top priority for the estate, as is connecting large sections of forest with wildlife corridors and forested buffer zones, very on brand for this episode. If you're ever in Penryn in Cornwall, I would really recommend popping by the roastery and getting a bag of their fresh coffee. A link to their website will be as ever in the description, along with more information on the specific organic decaf coffee above. Thank you all so much for listening. I've been your host, George Steedman-Jones, and this is Coffee with Conservationists.